Well, good evening. It's my pleasure to welcome you to the opening session of the 21st Annual Symposium of the International Center for Law and Religion Studies here at the J. Reuben Clark Law School. My name is Jim Rasband. I'm the Dean of the J. Reuben Clark Law School, and it's my honor to welcome you to Utah, to the mountains, and to Brigham Young University, and particularly to the J. Reuben Clark Law School. We're honored to have so many distinguished guests with us here on campus, and I hope that you'll feel welcome during your time here in the next couple of days. You come from all around the world, indeed from 42 different countries, and we're delighted to have you here to discuss and consider the many complex and challenging legal issues that surround the relationship of states and religious institutions. We're honored tonight to be joined on the dais by University President Kevin J. Worthen, whom I'll have a chance to introduce in a minute, and we're particularly pleased also and to welcome tonight and to thank our distinguished keynote speaker, Senator Orrin Hatch, who's not only one of the senior statesmen and leading figures in the United States Senate, but who's also been a great friend to our law school over the years. And I look forward to hearing his remarks in a few minutes. As we begin tonight, and as is our tradition at the J. Reuben Clark Law School, we will begin with a prayer, and that prayer will be offered by Janet Nelson. Janet is a member of the General Young Women's Board of our sponsoring church and is from Brooklyn, New York. Janet.
Our dear, kind Heavenly Father, we gather this evening with gratitude in our hearts that we are able to gather, that we live in a land that grants us the freedom to do so. We are grateful for all of those who have gathered in this room and pray that thou will bless all those who will be speaking tonight and who will be presenting over the next few days and also who will be listening, that their hearts can be opened, that they can be inspired, and that there can be a feeling of cooperation and respect. Heavenly Father, please help us in our own spheres of influence that we can be respectful, tolerant, and kind to those who do not believe as we do. And please help us to influence for good those who would not promote freedom of religion, that through our kind acts and through our goodness that we can help them see the benefits. Please bless the leaders of countries throughout the world, that there can be dialogue, there can be understanding and compromise so as to promote freedom of religion throughout the world. We love thee. We thank thee for the influence of religion in our lives. And we say this in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen. Amen.
As we begin, I also wanted to thank my colleague here at the law school, Professor Cole Durham, and those who work with him in the International Center for making this symposium happen. 21 of these don't come off without an awful lot of work, and I'm grateful to all those who make this a reality tonight. I'm also grateful to the individuals and families and foundations who provided funding, as well as their time and energy to help make this symposium happen, and also to support the scholarship and other work of this center all over the world. Some of their names are produced on page 14 of this program, and I'm grateful not only to them, but to all who make this work possible. Now, as Dean of the Law School, I hope you'll indulge me for just a couple of minutes to tell you a bit about the BYU Law School. And if I brag a little much, please forgive me. In fact, I've been accused of what is called burging, or B-I-R-G-I-N-G, basking in the reflected glory of others. It's actually a psychological condition where one comes to the point where one believes that the accomplishments of others are his own. And that's where I am with my colleagues at the law school. But the law school was founded in 1973. It has approximately 425 students, about 135 in each of the three classes. We also have a small LLM program, a Master of Law program, that consists of foreign lawyers who join us for a year. Approximately 77% of our students here at the law school speak a foreign language. Some of you will have the opportunity, I hope, to meet our students. Of the 425 students, almost 100 speak two foreign languages, and a number speak three or more. By their entering credentials, our students are in the top 15% of law classes in the country. In fact, the most prestigious opportunity for a graduate following law school in the United States is the opportunity to clerk for the United States Supreme Court. The court has only 36 law clerks each year who work with the justices of the court. And in a minute, in fact, I'll introduce the president of the university who is a part of that distinguished group. But over the last decade, the BYU Law School has produced more Supreme Court law clerks than all but 12 other law schools in the United States. Now, you'll notice that the halls will be quite quiet this week. Students aren't here due to what is called a placement break. They're out searching for employment. But I'm grateful to our students who have stayed here to help this evening and to make the hosting go. I believe you'll enjoy meeting them and getting to know them. They're really the crown jewel of this law school. As a law school, our goal is to provide our students with an extraordinary education that prepares them to be contributors throughout the world. But we also value here at the law school the opportunity to discuss matters of religious faith. Although most of the day-to-day of our legal education is made up of the hard work of learning the law, it is freedom of religion and belief that allows us to attempt the grand experiment of combining a first-class law school with an abiding religious commitment. So you can imagine how important the work of the center is to us. But by its very nature, freedom of religion and belief cannot be a concern just for our law school. It must be a concern of all and for all, those of different religious faiths and those of no religious faith at all. As the members of this particular group are acutely aware, the precise contours of religion, of freedom of religion and belief, in conjunction with the other needs and goals of the state, are not always an easy or a clear matter. Thus, we're delighted that you're here to contemplate these challenging questions with us over the next couple of days. Again, let me just welcome you to the mountains, welcome you to the BYU Law School. I look forward to getting to know many of you over the next couple of days of the symposium. It's now my pleasure to introduce my friend, the president of Brigham Young University, Kevin J. Worthen. President Worthen received his bachelor's degree from BYU, graduating summa cum laude. He's also a product of our law school. He graduated from the BYU Law School, number one in his class, following which he clerked for Judge Malcolm Wilkie on the United States Circuit Court for the District of Columbia, and then for Justice Byron White of the United States Supreme Court. After 2 years of law practice in Phoenix, Arizona, he returned to the BYU Law School as a member of our faculty. As a faculty member, he specialized in federal Indian law and in the rights of indigenous peoples. He spent a year as a Fulbright scholar studying the cultural and ethnic assimilation of Chile's native populations. His scholarship appeared in a variety of prestigious journals, including the Harvard Law Review. While at the law school, he was named the Hugh W. Colton Professor of Law. And from 2004 to 2008, he served as dean of the law school before moving across to the university and serving as the advancement vice president, in which he oversaw athletics and the broadcasting facility here on campus, as well as LDS Philanthropies, alumni, and communications. Just last month, President Worthen was inaugurated as the 13th president of Brigham Young University, although he's been serving in that position since last spring. I wish the president's schedule weren't so full with countless responsibilities and obligations, because I'd love for each of you to spend some time with him. I'm sure he'd love nothing more, frankly, than to stay and to participate in your dialogue over the next couple of days. I'd love for you to spend time with the president, and as you might assume from his extraordinary credentials, he's a person of great capacity. but he's also someone of genuine warmth and humility. In fact, while he was an undergraduate student, he spent 2 summers working in the coal mines of central Utah, and I think he's never forgotten what it means to have fewer opportunities. But at his core, the president's a peacemaker. He's a listener who's at his very best when counseling with colleagues about a challenging issue. He's a wise judge, and Brigham Young University is very lucky to have him as its president. Gives me great pleasure now to introduce to you and allow him to greet you, the president of Brigham Young University, Kevin J. Worthen.
Thank you, Jim, for that, as usual, kind and overly generous introduction. You mentioned humility, and what came to mind was Winston Churchill's comment, which seems applicable to me, talking about someone. He said he is a modest man with a lot of things to be modest about. So it truly is an honor and a pleasure to welcome you here to the 21st Annual International Law and Religion Symposium. I remember days before it was held in this building and held up at the Harmon Building before. It's come quite a ways. We welcome you, as the Dean Razvan said, from over 40 countries to discuss the important topic of law and religion. I especially welcome our keynote speaker, Senator Orrin Hatch, who is not only a distinguished alumnus of this university, but a great champion of religious liberty, both in the United States and internationally, a prime mover behind the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, as well as the International Religious Freedom Act. It truly is a pleasure to honor him tonight, as we do, and to hear from him, and I look forward to that. The topic that's been chosen for this year's symposium, Varieties of Secularism, Religion, and the Law, is both timely and timeless, in a sense. The fact that it's timely is apparent from anything, if you know anything that's happened in the world in the last 2 years, from discussions in Europe over the role of religion and religious beliefs in the public arena, to the Middle East, where questions about how, if there is any division between religion and the law, abound. And these are difficult issues, as Dean Razvan have said. These are not new issues. They've been around for centuries, and I don't think they're likely to go away. Despite concerns by those on the religious side that secularism is going to take over everything, and despite centuries-long predictions from others that religion would eventually disappear, I think they're both going to be with us for quite a while. That is something that is part of the human condition, and the debate about the proper accommodation between the secular and the sacred is an important one in which we have a big stake, in which the entire world has a big stake. It's fitting from my standpoint, I believe, that this kind of discussion is held at this university, which was founded on the firm conviction that secular and religious knowledge can complement and reinforce rather than compete with one another. As one of our church presidents said, we believe firmly that faith in the Almighty can accompany and enrich scholarship in the secular. We are the largest. Brigham Young University is the largest religiously affiliated university in the United States, with a student enrollment of over 30,000 students. The students are bright, talented, and friendly, and as Dean Razvan said, you'll get a chance to see that on your own if you haven't already experienced it. All of these students have agreed to conduct their lives in accordance with standards which reflect the underlying values and principles of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. This is truly a faith-based university, and it produces outstanding graduates. Just one example, there are only 4 universities in the United States that over the last 10 years have produced more graduates who have gone on to receive their PhDs at any institution in the United States. Now, BYU is a fitting location not only because of its strong religious affiliation, but also because of its equally strong focus on international matters. Students come to BYU from over 100 countries, and reflecting what is true in the law school, nearly 70% of the students, of those 30,000 students, speak a second language. 16% of them speak at least 3 languages. We regularly teach on campus on a regular basis 50 different languages, and at one time or another, over the last 3 or 4 years, have taught another 30 languages, depending upon the demand from the students. Each semester, 32% of our students are enrolled in a foreign language class. To give you some perspective, the national average is 9%. With over 130 programs in over 55 countries, we have one of the most extensive study abroad programs in the United States. And 65% of our students have lived outside the United States for more than 1 year. Now, that's actually a more impressive statistic than may appear to those who are familiar with our missionary program, because fewer than 60% of our students are returned missionaries, and many of them serve within the United States. So when 65% of them have lived overseas for a year, that's actually quite a telling statistic. As a sign at one of the entrances to the universities puts fairly well, the world is our campus. So we welcome you here. I trust you will have both an intellectually and I hope a spiritually invigorating experience as you discuss these important topics. I thank you and thank you on behalf of the university for your willingness to travel here and look forward to your contributions as we learn together here. Thank you very much.
Well, it's my privilege as director of the International Center for Law and Religion Studies to introduce Senator Hatch. We are in the course of introducing him. I'm going to read not only facts of introduction, but the citation for this year's Distinguished Service Award. The Distinguished Service Award goes to Senator Orrin G. Hatch, a dedicated supporter of religious freedom in America. In recent years, there has perhaps been no other public figure as active or as supportive of religious freedom in America as Senator Orrin Hatch. His support for religious liberty has been manifest in many initiatives and legislative proposals he has championed through his Senate service. Orrin Grant Hatch was born in 1934 to Jesse and Helen Hatch, whose ancestors had helped settle Vernal, Utah. It's by coincidence somewhere some of my own ancestors were from, so I just have to put in that plug for Vernal. He learned the value of hard work at an early age, initially following in his father's footsteps as a mental lather. He married Elaine Hansen of Newton, Utah, and together they established a family. Today they are the proud parents of 6 children, 23 grandchildren, and 10 great-grandchildren. Orrin Hatch was elected to the United States Senate from the state of Utah in 1976. His electoral victory came as a surprise to many. He had entered the race as a young and relatively unknown political outsider who was considered to have little chance. He ended up beating not only other contenders within the Republican Party, but also winning by a solid margin against a 3-term Democratic incumbent. Senator Hatch has had an important influence on U.S. legislation over a Senate career spanning nearly 4 decades. Now, in his 7th term as Utah Senator, Orrin Hatch has championed a variety of legislative causes. Notable among his prestigious assignments have been his long service as chair or ranking member of the Senate Judiciary Committee, his membership on the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee, his current service as the ranking member on the Senate Finance Committee, and as member of the Board of Directors for the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum. Senator Hatch has played a truly significant role, perhaps the leading role, in shaping legislation affecting religious freedom in America. In 1993, Senator Hatch led the fight to pass the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, known by its friends as RFRA, garnering near unanimous support in both parties. RFRA is arguably the most important religious liberty legislation of the 20th century. It provides heightened protection to religious organizations and limits government's ability to substantially burden an individual's or religious group's exercise of religion. In 1997, after the Supreme Court limited RFRA's application to the federal government, that is, said it couldn't apply to the states, Senator Hatch introduced the Religious Liberty Protection Act to limit the scope of the Supreme Court's decision. This was followed by Senator Hatch's introduction of the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act, or LUPA, which Congress unanimously passed within just 2 weeks in 2000. Our LUPA applies the RFRA legal standard to prison inmates and churches in zoning disputes. Senator Hatch's legislative initiatives have also included the 1979 introduction of the Religious Freedom in the Workplace Act and the Religious Liberty and Charitable Donation Clarification Act, which was signed into law in 2006. The senator's advocacy on behalf of religious liberty has extended to the judicial branch as well. He recently filed amicus briefs in the Hobby Lobby case in both the U.S. Court of Appeals and the U.S. Supreme Court, and he has worked for many years to confirm judges that understand and respect the importance of religious rights. Senator Hatch has also taken opportunities throughout his Senate service to educate Americans on the importance of religious liberty. Summing up Senator Hatch's leadership on religious liberty, Professor Michael McConnell, one of America's leading religious liberty scholars and director of the Constitutional Law Center at Stanford Law School, has written, quote, "No senator has fought longer or more effectively in defense of religious liberty for all Americans," unquote, than Senator Orrin Hatch. Utah Senator Orrin Hatch is a loyal advocate for religious liberty. On behalf of my colleagues and as director of the International Center for Law and Religion Studies at Brigham Young University, it gives me great pleasure to honor Senator Orrin G. Hatch as the 2014 Distinguished Service Award recipient for his outstanding contributions to the defense of religious freedom during his long career of public service in the United States Senate.
This is a copy of the citation, and this is the, we'll take pictures afterwards.
Well, President Werthen, it's always a privilege to be with you, Dean. Great to see you again. And Cole, for your work all over the world on religious liberty and freedom. I also noticed that, I don't know where he's sitting, but Cliff Wallace is here. Where are you, Cliff? Oh, right down here in front. Cliff Wallace is the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, former chief judge, who is still on the circuit and travels all over the world on legal matters. And he's one of my closest friends and should have been on the Supreme Court. We're very fortunate to know you and your lovely wife, who's a wonderful violinist, by the way. But it's a privilege for me to be with all of you here today at the 21st Annual International Law and Religion Symposium. I might mention, President, that two of your classmates were hired by me right out of law school. One is now a federal judge. The other one rose to great heights as a really, really great lawyer back in Washington. So this has been a great school for helping us, and I always appreciate my privilege of being a student at this school, by the way. I put myself through BYU as a janitor. I want you all to know that. It is a privilege to be with you today. I'm humbled to be added to the list of distinguished scholars and jurists from around the world who have given this address in the past. This is an unsettled and unsettling time for religious liberty. Both at home and abroad, religious liberty is under attack. What was once a broad consensus here in the United States that religious freedom deserves special protection has recently crumbled. Indeed, President Obama and his administration have taken positions openly hostile to religious liberty. And to cite just two examples, the administration argued in the Supreme Court that the federal government may control a church's decisions to hire or fire its own ministers. The administration also claimed authority to force employers to violate deeply held religious beliefs in providing health benefits to employees. At the state level, hundreds of small business owners across the country have faced fines, bankruptcy, and other sanctions under public accommodations laws for following their religious convictions. Internationally, we see many troubling attacks on religious liberty. In Nigeria, Boko Haram continues to attack, maim, and kill Christians in its campaign of terror. In Iran, a man was recently executed for heresy after he questioned the accuracy of certain religious texts. One such dissenter was recently killed by his jailer while awaiting trial. The rise of ISIS and other Islamist groups in the Middle East poses a significant threat to fragile religious freedoms in that region. And nations from Europe to Australia are considering bans on various types of religious clothing. I would like to take my short time with you this evening to explain why religious liberty matters, how it is under attack, and what each of us as global citizens and thought leaders can do to protect this most precious and fundamental freedom. First, why religious freedom matters. Professor Thomas Berg of the University of St. Thomas writes that one of America's greatest contributions to the world has been establishing a religious freedom as both social reality and constitutional principle. I believe this formulation is not only descriptive, but can also be prescriptive, and it will form the basis of my remarks this evening. Religious freedom in America was social reality before it became constitutional principle. For nearly two centuries before the founding of this republic, one religious community after another came here to live their faith. Puritans, Congregationalists, Roman Catholics, Jews, Quakers, Baptists, Presbyterians, and Methodists all found refuge on these shores. Professor Michael McConnell, who has been mentioned, of Stanford, has noted that in the years before the Revolution, America experienced a higher degree of religious diversity than existed anywhere else in the world. Religious freedom as social reality in America has traditionally had three dimensions. First, it has been freedom not only of belief, but also of behavior. Second, it has been freedom that may be exercised publicly as well as privately. And third, it has been freedom to act both individually and collectively. This robust social reality was the backdrop for our Constitution. America's founders knew that liberty necessitates limits on government, but they were divided as to what those limits should be. Some thought that simply listing the powers of Congress in the body of the Constitution was enough, that enumeration was effectively self-limiting. Others were more skeptical about government power and demanded affirmative action for particular rights. The skeptics won the day, and the first right named in the Bill of Rights is the freedom of religion. Note that the First Amendment protects the free exercise of religion, a phrase that had been in use for more than a century before James Madison incorporated it in the First Amendment. Not a particular exercise of religion, or the exercise of religion by a particular person, or the exercise of religion for a particular purpose. The Constitution protects the free exercise of religion itself. Religious freedom, then, is not simply one of many competing values, but a special and preferred value. It is a central reason that America exists at all. 95% of Americans, in fact, believe that one of the principal reasons America was founded was to enable people of all faiths to believe and practice their religion. The U.S. Supreme Court attaches the label fundamental to the most important rights. Fundamental rights are rights that are protected from virtually any encroachment and that take precedence over other interests or values. These rights, the court has said, are deeply rooted in this nation's history and tradition and are implicit in the concept of ordered liberty itself. Religious freedom is one of those fundamental rights. Religious freedom, however, is not an American invention. It is, in fact, the oldest internationally recognized human right with a heritage going back at least to the Reformation. Nor is religious freedom a uniquely American ideal. In 1948, after the horror of World War II, numerous nations, including the United States, signed the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Article 18 of that declaration states that every person has a fundamental right to freedom of religion, including, quote, freedom either alone or in community with others and in public or private to manifest his religion or belief in teaching, practice, worship, and observance, unquote. Here again, we see the three dimensions of truly robust religious freedom: belief and behavior, private and public, individual and collective. Genuine religious freedom exists when these three dimensions are both social reality and constitutional principle and are understood as fundamental. In 1998, Congress unanimously passed the International Religious Freedom Act. I was pleased to support that act, which created an ambassador at large for international religious freedom within the Department of State and established the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. Cole Durham knows an awful lot about these matters. He's gone all over the world. We're really fortunate to have him here at this great institution. The ambassador submits reports to Congress each year addressing religious freedom in other countries. Based on these reports, the Secretary of State may designate countries that engage in systematic, ongoing, and egregious violations of religious liberty as countries of particular concern. The U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom also submits independent annual reports that go into greater depth on selected countries that, in the Commission's independent judgment, deserve greater scrutiny. The Commission is a bipartisan 9-member body that investigates religious freedom around the world and holds hearings to educate Congress and the public about instances of religious persecution. The Commission's immediate past chairman, Professor Robert George of Princeton, last year wrote about what he called religious freedom in its most robust sense. Religious freedom is far more than a mere right to worship or to believe in private, he said, but the right to express one's faith in public. According to Professor George, to overcome the powerful and broad presumption in favor of religious liberty, political authority must meet a heavy burden. The Commission's current chair, Katrina Landau-Sweat, who I know very well, is equally vigorous in affirming religious freedom and has special links to Brigham Young University because of her membership in The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. The social reality of religious freedom has an additional, more practical dimension. America's founders, including George Washington, spoke about religion's role in helping to create good citizens. The Massachusetts Constitution of 1780 similarly declared that general happiness, good order, and civil government all depend on piety, religion, and morality. And the eminent Alexis de Tocqueville, writing in the 19th century, observed that Americans all across all classes and parties believed that religion is indispensable to the maintenance of well-functioning political institutions. This topic has more recently been the subject of conferences and a growing body of scholarship. Professor Mary Ann Glendon of Harvard, for example, has argued persuasively, in my opinion, about how violence tends to be greater in societies that suppress religious liberty and that religious freedom correlates with democratic longevity. The last several American presidents have issued proclamations each year naming a day in January as Religious Freedom Day. These proclamations are by presidents of both parties, have made some of the same points I have discussed tonight. President Bill Clinton reminded us that religious freedom is a natural right and is essential to our well-being and dignity as human beings. President George W. Bush said that religious freedom is a cornerstone of the American public and a fundamental human right that contributes to stable democracy. Now, I have described the history to a degree of religious freedom in America to place in stark relief the consequences of weakening and constricting this freedom. A few blocks from the U.S. Capitol in Washington, D.C. is the National Archives, which houses the most important documents from America's founding. Excuse me. Reaching the main entrance requires walking past a statue on which is inscribed the axiom, "Eternal vigilance is the price of liberty." That vigilance is necessary to ensure that religious liberty remains both social reality and meaningful constitutional privilege or principle. Unfortunately, both dimensions, religious freedom in America, are eroding. In terms of social reality, while nearly 90% of Americans say that religion is important in their personal lives, 3/4 believe religion is losing its influence in our society, the highest level in 60 years. In several ways, pressure is mounting to deprive religious freedom of its foundational status in the cultural and political life of our nation. For example, arguments have been made in both the political arena and in America's courts that laws should not and even may not be based on religious considerations. Elder Dallin H. Oaks of the LDS Church addressed this notion several months ago at Utah Valley University's Constitutional Symposium on religious freedom. The argument against basing laws on religious considerations goes like this. Because religion is a private rather than a public matter, or so the argument claims, the only legitimate basis for public debate and political decision-making is so-called public reasons, which are defined to exclude religious values and expressions. Now, this view attacks all three of the dimensions of religious freedom that I described earlier. It insists that religion is limited to belief, not behavior, that religious exercise is individual, not collective, and especially that religion is something that should be conducted in private, not in public. Religious freedom as a constitutional principle is also under attack in at least two ways. The first is through a general decline in American citizens' knowledge about our Constitution, our history, our heritage, and our form of government. James Madison, a particular principal author of the Constitution, wrote that only a well-instructed people can permanently remain a free people. Citizens cannot understand, let alone defend, what they do not know. Yet today, poll after poll shows that Americans are shockingly ignorant of even the most basic matters relating to their nation and their liberty. Author James Bavard aptly calls this attention deficit democracy. I thought that was pretty good. This general decline in Americans' knowledge about government sets the stage for the second way in which religious freedom as a constitutional principle is threatened. For 150 years after America's founding, a consensus existed that judges have only a modest role in interpreting a written constitution. Because the Constitution expresses the people's will about government power and individual rights, that consensus maintained only the people have authority to change the Constitution. But ignorance about American history, our political system, and the requirements of liberty has allowed a radical transformation in the courts, because since the 1930s, presidents have increasingly appointed judges willing to impose their own meaning on the Constitution rather than draw the people's meaning from it. I mention this because the personal values and preferences of these activist judges have imposed, they've been uniformly hostile to religion and religious freedom. The First Amendment prohibits federal establishment of religion and protects the free exercise of religion. America's founders viewed the Establishment Clause narrowly, and the Free Exercise Clause, broadly. A combination that allowed for robust, I think I will take that, thanks. It's great to have the president of the university working for you. Thank you, President. Okay, let me go over that again, because that's an important point. The First Amendment prohibits federal establishment of religion and protects the free exercise of religion. America's founders viewed the Establishment Clause narrowly and the Free Exercise Clause broadly. It's an accommodation that really allowed for robust religious freedom and an active role for religion in public life. Judges who have felt free to impose their own values, however, have consistently reversed that order, interpreting the Establishment Clause broadly and the Free Exercise Clause narrowly. The result has been a continued diminishing of religious freedom and an increasingly muted role for religion in public life. In a case titled Lee versus Weissman, the Supreme Court in 1992 held that an invocation before a public school graduation ceremony was an establishment of religion prohibited by the First Amendment. Such invocations had been common throughout our history and are still practiced in legislatures across America, including my own United States Senate, where I serve. The argument seemed to be, at least in the public school context, that the mere uttering of religious words in the form of a prayer was an unconstitutional establishment of religion. While the Wiseman decision broadened the meaning of the Establishment Clause, a decision 2 years earlier narrowed the Free Exercise Clause. The Supreme Court had for decades held that government action burdening religious exercise must meet a legal standard called strict scrutiny that requires a compelling justification for the government's action. Applying this standard identifies the free exercise of religion as a fundamental value while also allowing for some restrictions under narrow circumstances. An Oregon state law prohibited the use of controlled substances, including the drug peyote. Two Native American state employees were fired for using peyote in their religious ceremonies and argued that this violated their First Amendment right to free exercise of their religion. The U.S. Supreme Court disagreed, rejecting the view that there must be religious exemptions for laws such as Oregon's controlled substance ban. Instead, it held that any neutral law of general applicability could override religious freedom claims and that the strict scrutiny standard would apply only when government explicitly targets religion and in certain other narrowly defined contexts. This decision entitled Employment Division versus Smith was deeply troubling, certainly was to me. And I don't like peyote either, but these were Native Americans. Better make that clear. But these were Native Americans practicing their religion. By significantly narrowing the circumstances in which religious exercise would be protected as a fundamental value, subject to strict scrutiny, the court significantly broadened the circumstances in which it would be subject to all sorts of government controls. In one fell swoop, the court reversed decades of precedent, disregarded centuries of practice, and threatened to upend religious liberty status as a preferred value in American society. I knew that I had to do everything in my power as a United States Senator to limit Smith's effect. And so I led a campaign to reverse the Supreme Court's decision and restore heightened protection for religious liberty. The culmination of these efforts was the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, or RFRA, which I sponsored in the United States Senate. RFRA was a rare bill that attracted broad, indeed nearly unanimous, bipartisan support. RFRA's purpose was to reinstate the broad protection religious liberty enjoyed prior to Smith, to the Smith case. It said simply and plainly that, quote, government shall not substantially burden a person's exercise of religion, even if the burden results from a rule of general applicability, unquote. Now, this means that government cannot pass laws or take action that substantially impedes a person's practice of religion, even when the law is targeted to some other non-religious purpose and affects everyone, religious and non-religious, equally. Nor is there any limit on subject matter. All government action that substantially burdens religious liberty is prohibited, regardless of whether it involves the environment, education, transportation, or healthcare, just to mention a few. RFRA also contains an exception. Government can substantially burden a person's exercise of religion, but only if two conditions are both met. First, the government measure must advance a compelling government interest. Secondly, it must be the least restrictive means of advancing that interest. This is the so-called strict scrutiny test that applied before the Smith decision. In order to intrude on religious liberty, government must have a very, very good reasons for doing so. And the intrusion must be necessary to accomplish that goal. If there is an alternative way to accomplish the same result that does not intrude on religious liberty, the government must take it if they want to proceed. Put differently, government may intrude on religious liberty only when it has no other choice. This restores religious freedom to its proper place in the pantheon of values. Other values and interests take a back seat where religious rights are involved. As you can see, RFRA is an incredibly expansive statute. It applies to all government action and requires government to satisfy strict conditions before it can intrude on religious liberty. Equally broad was the coalition that passed RFRA. The bill passed the House of Representatives unanimously. Think about that, unanimously. There was not a single dissenting vote in the House. Even the vote to authorize the use of military force against Al-Qaeda following 9/11 was not unanimous. RFRA passed the Senate, we're a little slower, they passed the Senate 97-3, nearly unanimous. The day President Clinton signed RFRA into law was one of the most pleasing days of my life. I don't like to use the word proudest, it's in the speech, but it was one of the most pleasing days, without question. RFRA has not had an uncomplicated history in the courts. In 1997, the Supreme Court held that Congress lacked constitutional authority to impose a stricter standard of religious freedom protection on the states than the Supreme Court had decreed in Smith. Intervening cases have confirmed that RFRA does restore the compelling interest test where federal legislation is involved. Significantly, 19 states now have adopted state religious freedom restoration acts, and courts in another 12 states have accomplished the same result by construing their state constitutions to require heightened scrutiny of religious freedom claims. Only 4 states have explicitly followed the reasoning of the Smith decision. Thus, while the Supreme Court narrowed the state protections provided by RFRA, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, the majority of states have followed the lead established by Congress in passing RFRA. RFRA was a broad law supported by a broad coalition that recognized the law's expansive scope. When President Clinton signed it into law 20 years ago, I was there. There was widespread agreement as to religious liberty's fundamental status and the fact that government should have to exhaust all other possible avenues before intruding on religious rights. But unfortunately, times have changed. Where once there was broad agreement, now there is discord. Earlier this year, in a case titled Burwell versus Hobby Lobby Stores, the Supreme Court held that Obamacare's birth control mandate did not sufficiently accommodate the free exercise of religion. The plaintiffs in the case argued that providing certain mandated birth control products would violate their deeply held religious beliefs regarding the sanctity of life. In ruling for the plaintiffs, the court found that there were available alternative means of accomplishing the policy objective of providing insurance coverage for birth control that would not force the plaintiffs to violate their sincere, deeply held religious beliefs. Set against the broad backdrop of American history of religious freedom as both social reality and constitutional principle, the court's decision was not remarkable at all. But throughout American society, the longstanding consensus about religious freedom has, alas, deteriorated. And the court's decision has proven controversial. As with Smith, members of Congress responded to the Hobby Lobby decision with legislation to overturn it. But there was a key difference between the decisions. Smith diminished religious freedom, whereas Hobby Lobby secured it. Think about that. In 1993, Congress responded to the Smith decision that had weakened religious freedom with legislation to protect it. In 2014, however, a mere 2 decades later, many members of Congress, including many who had voted for RFRA, responded to the Hobby Lobby decision that had protected religious freedom with legislation to weaken it. Nor are these attempts to diminish religious liberty in the wake of Hobby Lobby limited to the specific facts of the case. Hobby Lobby dealt with Obamacare's birth control mandate. The proposed legislative responses to Hobby Lobby, however, sweep much more broadly. They would exempt from RFRA's strict scrutiny requirement not just birth control coverage, but all federal laws and regulations relating to health care. Think about that. Justice Smith provoked a broad legislative response, so did Hobby Lobby. The difference is that in 1993, there was near unanimity that religious liberty deserves the highest protection, whereas now a significant portion of Congress believes religious liberty deserves no particular protection, at least where health care is involved. I've served in the U.S. Senate for nearly 38 years. In fact, at the end of this year, it will be 38 years. And have been involved in developing, negotiating, drafting, and enacting thousands of bills. Rarely have I seen a bill that was clearer or more simple, or more simpler, I should say, than the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. In 1993, Congress was nearly unanimous that the free exercise of religion was to continue its preferred place in our hierarchy of values. Just 20 years later, many of the very same senators and congressmen who supported RFRA are now pushing legislation that would render it impotent. Now, let me just tell you, when I started to push this bill in the United States Senate, I went to my friend Ted Kennedy. I said, "You're going to be on this bill with me." "No, I'm not. No, I'm not." I said, "Yes, you are." So he came on the bill, and of course that presented a bipartisan approach to this. And I might add, we marched right through the Senate and were able to get it through 97-3. When it was signed on the South Lawn, I might add, one of the apostles from my religion was there with me, and when it was signed on the South Lawn by President Clinton, the biggest duck in the puddle was Senator Kennedy. He was so proud of having passed that bill. And with good reason. I believe he would be appalled at some of the approaches today, except then again, it's tough for Democrats not to take some of the positions they have, but there are some who are not too. But another way in which religious freedom is being pulled down from its preferred status is by placing it in conflict with other rights, including statutory rights. This situation occurs, for example, when the constitutional right to the free exercise of one's religion is said to conflict with a statutory right to be free from discrimination. The U.S. Supreme Court addressed this issue in 2012 in a case called Hosanna Tabor, Evangelical Lutheran Church versus EEOC. In Hosanna Tabor, a religious denomination argued that a First Amendment right to determine who would serve as its ministers created an exception to a federal law prohibiting employment discrimination. Ordinarily, the proposition that statutes must conform to the Constitution is accepted as an obvious principle. A conflict between the two typically comes before the courts when a party alleges that a statute violates the Constitution. This case, however, came to the Supreme Court in the opposite posture. The plaintiff employee argued, in effect, that the Constitution violated the statute. The Supreme Court, thankfully, rejected this twisted view and instead vindicated the First Amendment right of churches to choose their own ministers free from governmental interference. That seems like something that anybody would agree with. Notwithstanding this clear judicial victory, however, the case revealed something very disturbing, even offensive, about the Obama administration's view of religious freedom. The administration argued that there was no need for a special religious exception to federal discrimination law because all groups, religious and secular, already enjoy some level of protection under the First Amendment freedom of association. As the court explained in rejecting this remarkable proposition, the administration wrongly believed that, quote, "the First Amendment analysis should be the same whether the association in question is a Lutheran church, a labor union, or a social club," unquote. Now let that sink in for a moment. The President of the United States was arguing that a church's right to select its leader free from governmental interference was no different from that of a scout troop, a local Kiwanis club, or an intramural sports team. The administration, in effect, was asking the court to read the free exercise clause right out of the First Amendment and hold that a church is no different from any other group in terms of relation to government. Churches, in the administration's view, are just another social group, or at least that's what they said. Thankfully, the Supreme Court rejected this position unanimously, noting that, quote, the text of the First Amendment itself gives special solicitude to the rights of religious organizations, unquote. Now, you would think that this point would be obvious to the president and his lawyers. Do not think, however, that the Obama administration has consistently argued that statutes trump the Constitution. Just last year, for example, the Obama administration argued to the Supreme Court that the Federal Defense of Marriage Act violated the Fifth Amendment's implicit guarantee of equal protection. Now, lay aside for a moment the remarkable fact that the Obama administration chose not to defend a duly enacted federal law, which the Constitution says they should do, defend it. Focus instead on this fact. It became the official position of the United States that, on the one hand, an implicit constitutional right trumps a federal statute recognizing the millennia-old, religiously-rooted traditional definition of marriage, while on the other hand, an explicit constitutional right to religious freedom fails against a federal anti-discrimination statute. Now, it would be difficult to imagine a more direct attack on the fundamental status of religious liberty. The alleged conflict between religious liberty and anti-discrimination laws represents another area where the former consensus favoring religious liberty has fallen apart. Last year, I was proud to support the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, or ENDA, which would prohibit discrimination in hiring and employment on the basis of sexual orientation. I supported that bill through the Senate. The bill, which contained a robust exemption for religious organizations that I made sure was in there, struck the right balance between religious liberty and a competing right. It advanced the cause of equality by prohibiting workplace discrimination against gays and lesbians, but also protected the rights of religious organizations. In this way, it maintained religious liberty as a preferred right. Many LGBT advocacy groups, however, have since withdrawn their support for ENDA expressly because of its religious exemption. In their view, religious groups should be treated like any other groups, and the principle of equality should trump the right to religious liberty, regardless of what the Bible says or what religious people believe. Far from giving religious freedom preferred status, these groups would subsume it beneath other values. Now, we are seeing the same dynamic play out across the country as LGBT and other advocacy groups are increasingly opposed to religious exemptions that even a few years ago would have passed without conflict. Now, I am deeply concerned about this dynamic. I don't want us to be prejudiced against people. But by gosh, religion's really important. And we've got to be very careful when we legislate in these areas. From my perspective, it appears that now these groups believe that they are winning the argument and therefore have no need for religious accommodations. Whereas in the past they were willing to respect religious freedom, now that they believe they have the upper hand, they are ready to disregard religious liberty altogether. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court begins its new term tomorrow, the first Monday in October. On Tuesday, the court will consider a case presenting once again the question whether religious freedom remains a preferred value in American law and culture. In 2000, I introduced and Congress unanimously passed the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act. It was mentioned earlier. This law applies the same protective standard found in RFRA to the context of incarceration and local zoning practices. In the case to be argued this week, a Muslim prisoner in Arkansas was denied permission to grow a half-inch beard that his faith requires, even though the state allows prisoners to grow beards for medical reasons. As I described earlier, neither the First Amendment nor the statute makes religious exercise an absolute value, but it is a preferred value. The case is important because it measures whether a particular policy is the least restrictive means available or whether a particular purpose is compelling. For that reason, the court's decision may signal whether religious freedom remains fundamental. Tonight, I have painted what seems like a negative picture. Religious freedom in threefold dimension is being eroded and weakened as both social reality and constitutional principle. It is increasingly viewed not as a fundamental right or even as a preferred value, but at best as one of many competing interests, and at worst as something that should be kept out of the public square altogether. This trend not only restricts religious liberty, but also limits the impact faith has on society. I said at the outset that Professor Byrd's formulation of religious liberty as social reality and constitutional principle can be both descriptive and prescriptive. And I turn now to the latter as I conclude my remarks. The solution to the problems I have identified is to strengthen religious freedom as both social reality and constitutional principle. That may sound simplistic, but it is hardly simple. As we've seen, it is taking mere years to undermine and possibly destroy what took centuries to build. I agree with Professor Glendon of Harvard, who argues that whether religious freedom in the future will be a fundamental right is primarily a cultural challenge. Professor Glendon gave the 2011 Harold J. Berman Lecture at Emory University, and I commend it to your consideration. In her lecture, Professor Glendon endorsed legal and political efforts to defend religious liberty, but also said that in the end, success, quote, will depend even more on the attitudes and actions of religious believers and leaders themselves, unquote. I think Professor Glendon is absolutely right, exactly right, and I am deeply dismayed at the way contemporary society has come to treat religion. Much of this can be laid at the feet of the media. So much of what we see or hear in movies, on the radio, and particularly on television, seems to scorn or degrade religion. Churches and charities are depicted as corrupt and self-indulgent. Late-night comics treat believers as buffoons. Reporters fawn over atheists and agnostics who purport to speak truth to power by belittling our religious heritage, even as they enjoy more media coverage because of that heritage and a more lavish lifestyle than any parish priest could ever hope. When did religion become such a negative thing? How many movies must we endure where a villain is a priest, a pastor, or a self-righteous zealot? One might be excused for thinking that based on representations in popular media, religious organizations are forces for evil, rather than the backbone of much that is good and generous in our society. Nevertheless, we cannot lay all the blame at the feet of the media. To do so would be to pretend that we, academics, government leaders, journalists, are powerless. But we're not. Even if we cannot control what media elites disseminate, we can work within our own spheres of influence to remind our fellow citizens of our shared religious heritage and the tremendous good religion has accomplished in our society. First, we must be resolute against efforts to remove our religious heritage from educational curricula. I do not mean here to get into the debate about whether the United States is a, quote, Christian nation, unquote, or similar controversies. Rather, I mean to suggest that we should be honest with our children about the profound and profoundly positive impact that religion had on some of our greatest leaders. It is fashionable to question the Christianity of George Washington, and volumes have been written on Thomas Jefferson's heterodoxy. But the fact remains that nearly all of our greatest leaders, from Washington to Lincoln to Martin Luther King, were men of faith who found deep strength in their religious convictions. Our heroes were religious men and women. To teach this is not to inject religion into a place it does not belong. It is simply to state the truth. Remember, too, that many of our greatest social movements, from abolition to the civil rights movement of the 1960s, were led by religious individuals motivated by religious conviction. Second, we must reclaim the public square as a forum friendly for religion. Nearly 70 years ago, the Supreme Court committed legal and historical malpractice by importing into its early Establishment Clause jurisprudence the false notion that our founders intended to wall off religion from the public square. Myriad historians have since proved the court's error, but the idea it planted has flourished into a widespread belief that religion has no place in school, in government, or anywhere else in the public sphere. This is simply wrong. There should be room in all aspects of the public square for affirmations of religious devotion and recognition of the important role religion continues to play. This does not mean we should mandate school prayer, but it does mean we should allow students and government leaders to express religious views without condemnation and without criticism that religion is a purely private affair. I am deeply concerned by the movement to cut off school funding for religious groups that require leaders to affirm the group's religious beliefs. We should encourage, not hamstring, students' efforts to join together with co-believers. I am particularly concerned that some schools are eliminating funding for religious groups even while leaving funding for secular groups untouched. And I call on state officials to ensure that such schools are not using non-discrimination codes as a fig leaf for getting rid of disfavored religious groups. Third, we must support efforts to partner government with religious and charitable organizations to reach underserved populations. I believe that one of President George W. Bush's most important and least heralded initiatives was his effort to tap into the faith community's ability to provide services to the poor and underprivileged communities. President Bush recognized the tremendous work that religious groups do to care for and support the needy. He also recognized that faith-based organizations can often provide services more efficiently and more effectively than government can. These efforts show that government and religion are not antagonists, but partners. Fourth, we should highlight the good that religious leaders do for our nation. We are bombarded constantly with negative views and news about religious leaders. Pastors embezzling from their congregations, ministers cheating on their wives, priests abusing young worshipers. To be sure, there are bad apples in religious groups, as there are everywhere. But a few bad apples do not spoil all the apples in the whole barrel. Wouldn't it be nice for a change if among all the unrelenting negativity, there were some positive stories about lives changed for the better? There are awards, degrees, honoraria, prizes to be given, commissions, boards, panels to be filled, books, papers, studies to be written. Perhaps we could give greater thought to religious leaders in our communities that are deserving of such awards or available to serve on such commissions where their service can be recognized. Professional athletes and boorish musicians receive enough attention. Let's try to reserve some for our upstanding religious leaders. Fifth, we should work harder to convince people that religious freedom is worth protecting. A point made by Professor Christopher Lund at Wayne State University. For much of American history, we either assumed the answer or did not ask the question at all. But the heritage that began with social reality and became constitutional principle will not protect itself. Professor Lund writes that unless we do better at explicitly making this case, legislators will no longer enact laws such as RFRA, judges will not properly interpret constitutional provisions and statutes protecting religious freedom, and religious liberty will indeed no longer receive the standing in our society that it deserves. Sixth, we must affirm our own individual faith and devotion. As community leaders, we have the ability to reach and influence broad audiences. By publicly affirming our faith, we both show that faith does have a place in the public sphere and show community members that their leaders place a priority on religion. This does not mean that we should become public pastors, each one of us, but it does mean we should not be shy about our own beliefs. By demonstrating that religion is important to our own self-identity and desire to serve, we show our community members that religion is a thing of value and a source of motivation. And who knows? Showing others how religion has changed our lives may spark a desire in them to seek greater devotion in their own lives. There can be no greater protector of religious liberty than a society composed of individuals who actually value religion. Changing culture is no easy thing, and we here in this room are too small a group to direct a trajectory that has gone so far off course. But we are not the only people dedicated to religious liberty and concerned that it is retreating both here in the United States and across the world. The Pew Forum reports that 3/4 of the world's population live in countries with high government restrictions and significant social hostilities surrounding religion. And that level is increasing. In many places, religious freedom has never been social reality or constitutional principle. Many of our neighbors and fellow community leaders share our concerns about religious liberty's retreat. By reasserting religious freedom's proper place, we can appeal to those who recognize the importance of religious liberty, but are unsure of how to proceed. All over the world, they're concerned, but they don't know what to do. That's why this is so important, what you're doing, Professor Durham, and others, and why this great law school is playing such a role. You know, if we assert religious freedom's proper place, we can appeal to those who recognize the importance of religious liberty, but are unsure of how to proceed. By making the public square more friendly for religion, we can invite back into the square those who share our convictions but feel uncomfortable expressing those convictions in public. By working to make government and religion partners once more rather than antagonists, we can revive the view that religion is a force for good rather than something to be swept under the rug. And by ensuring that our religious heritage maintains a robust role in our educational curricula, we can ensure that our children understand that religion helped our heroes accomplish great things and made our nation what it is today. Religion may never be fashionable in the way that it once was. Our insular and insulated media elites will work to that end. I can guarantee that. But if we can help our young people to see religion as a force for good, they will be more inclined to protect it and to stand up against secularists who seek to rid religion from our history books and banish it from our public discourse. A 2011 survey revealed that 90% of Americans believe that religious freedom is an inherent right that is not granted by government. That is perhaps a slim read, but it is an essential belief for rebuilding the foundation of religious freedom. The preamble to our Constitution states that that charter was established to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. True religious freedom is essential for that security. And in that regard, I wish each of you God's blessing in seeking to advance the cause of religious liberty here in the United States and throughout the world. Thanks so much. It's great to be with you.